Take a network break. Greg's back from the IETF, loaded up with virtual donuts from Prague, which we'll be distributing through today's review of tech news. I'm Drew Conroy-Murray. This episode of Network Break is being brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is the resource to keep you and your IT team's skills up to date. Visit itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code NETWORKBREAK30 to get a free 7-day trial and 30% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. And stay tuned after the news to hear a sponsored coffee talk with Thousand Eyes, where we're going to talk about monitoring AWS performance. Greg, welcome back to the show.
Oh, hi. Who's been sitting in my chair?
We had Ethan and Tom try to keep it warm for you. I don't know.
Oh, is that why my porridge is missing? Who's been eating my porridge? My chair's
Who's been sleeping in my bed?
And there's kind of this weird smell around here. I don't know. Kind of strange.
A little gift.
They've left some yogurt hidden in a corner somewhere because I was away for weeks. Thanks, fellas. Nice.
Nice and ripe in a couple weeks.
They did a great job last week. Just goes to show you how pointless I am.
Not at all. We need your informed cynicism.
I like to think my posturing IT infrastructureista attitude brings something to the society that we live in.
A certain je ne sais quoi.
Yes, CC, oui.
All right, let's dive in. Before we start with the news, we have a couple of updates about things happening at Packet Pushers. One is a brand new membership program.
Yes, we've been building a membership system for quite some time, but we've been focused on making podcasts instead of focusing on the membership system. And we finally found some bandwidth to get it done. And the idea behind the membership is we have a lot of stuff that we bring together. Like, you know, we've got three different newsletters that we publish. We've got a Link Propagation, the Human Infrastructure Magazine newsletter, and we have a weekly summary newsletter that we send out every week. And a lot of people are subscribed to one or the other, but not all of them, or don't know how to do it. So the goal is that there's a bunch of free stuff that we would like to bring to you. So we'll build a membership system because that's the best way to do it. Now, that obviously leads to, in the future, once we work through getting everything slicked down and getting the deployment completed and signed off by change control, we're going to do two more membership platforms. One will be for supporters. So many people over the years have said, we'd like to support you financially for, you know, help you in some way. And they said, can we support you? So we'll be starting a supporters program in the next month or two. And then beyond that, there'll be a premium membership where we start bringing you content, which will have commentary and analysis and technology deep dives and things like that. But that's all in the future, and it'll all be gradual, and nothing will change in the podcast, right? So it'll always be the podcasts that you get now are free. Nothing changes with that. It's just that the membership will be a way for you to access new content and some of our non-podcast content, which sort of gets lost in the noise.
That's right. Yeah, so if you're interested in checking it out, just go over to packetpushers.net/members. You can sign up for free. We won't share your information, see what the benefits are, and if you like it, then that would be great.
Sure would.
The other thing we want to talk to you about is our audience survey. This is something that we do every year. We ask you to give us your feedback on how we're doing in terms of the content, the podcast, what we're covering, the topics, the vendor support. We also collect a little bit of demographic information because that helps us when we're working with sponsors. They want to know who is in the audience, what the audience is made up of. So I'll include a link in the show notes. If you have a minute or a little bit of time to go through the survey, we'd really appreciate it.
And we do literally, everybody hates surveys, including us. I promise you, I get really narked when every time I stay at a hotel, the first thing they do within 5 minutes of checkout is, "Sir, survey, how did that go?" It's like, you know, please, come on, just enough.
And yet here we are.
Yeah, here we are. But we only do it once a year and we'll never harass you again. And it's literally so our sponsors can get some idea of who you are and what you do and what matters. You know, we think we know who you are, but we just have to prove it. Nobody just wants to take our word for it, which is kind of a shame, really.
That's true. The lack of trust is just distressing.
And it's mildly amusing, or even more than a little bit amusing, according to some people. So it's not tedious and dull. We do ask a lot of pointless questions. And you know that Drew likes to write surveys into the Human Infrastructure magazine. If you're subscribed, some of them are quite humorous. So it's not boring.
Well, we try to make it a little bit fun. If you do take the time to go through the survey, we'd appreciate it. Okay. And in terms of the information we're sending, there's no personal information. It's just aggregate. So it's not like we're going to be telling VMware who you are specifically. It's just aggregate information.
No. None of that rubbish. No names, no email addresses, no home addresses, no fax numbers. No, just ask some questions, get some answers. Thanks very much. That'd be great if you could do that.
All right. And Greg, you were at the IETF all last week in Prague. How did that run?
So IETF 99, like I tell you what, if you're ever going to go visit somewhere for a holiday, Prague was lovely. It's not often I travel places. I'm not a huge traveling for business is not usually fun. It's usually something that you do with that's called work, and you do it and you get home. But I did really enjoy Prague. I had a lovely time walking around the old city there. Really enjoyed it. So from that point of view, I came into the IETF with a very positive attitude. The IETF remains its unique, the center of the fashion crime universe, I think I said on a couple of podcasts I recorded there.
You did note that, yes.
Wow. I mean, like, no fashion crime's gone uncommitted at that place, I tell you. There's just it's a full array of people that just don't normally get out in public. But they are doing some amazing things, amazing things. I sat in on a couple of sessions where they're talking about slicing and NFV. I recorded about 10 podcasts, I think, with a really wide range. Some of them are short, they're 20 minutes, and some of them are long, 40 minutes, 50 minutes, talking about things like auto configuration of ISIS and auto production, like building a data center fabric. You click everything together and ISIS will auto configure, auto detect, and auto topologize its configuration, and boom, ECMP spine built out of ISIS, which is really interesting. And then there's going to be some interesting further podcasts around that with various people who I met during the event that I wasn't able to record for lack of time. So the IETF is still the center of the known universe. That's where our standards come from. That's what drives, you know, much of the internet working connectivity. And it's still a source of delight and frustration at the same time to me.
Sure. Yeah, any standards process would, yes.
Yeah. And it's all about volunteers. So I was really pleased to meet up. There was a group there called EDCO, Enterprise Data Center Operators. And they're sort of like a group of enterprise people who want to get enterprise involved in the IETF. So watch out for a show with Darren Patis, where I talk very briefly, like in 15 minutes or less, because there's not that much to tell about it. And if you're an enterprise person who wants to get involved in the IETF, this might be a way for you to find common interests and ways to get engaged. But as always, you know, the IETF is, you know, like I said, it's both frustrating, but it's also the place where stuff gets done. And he who shows up gets to do stuff. And it's not actually so much about somebody said, I always thought the IETF was the best of the best. And I went, no, it's about whoever shows up and does the work. And that could be you.
That could be you then. Why not?
Yeah. If I wasn't running a company, you know, if I had like a salary owner who would let me do that, I would probably do that. You know, I'd be that person I'd be criticizing.
And so the tables turn.
Ah, yes, indeed.
And remember, this is audio, so you won't have to witness yourself any of the sartorial faux pas that occurred at the...
No. It's just there are people there who, you know, look like they've been straight out of the university campus or the 1970s. And wow, it's quite something.
They've got other things to think about.
Yeah, they're focused on the eyes on the prize. Eyes on the prize, yeah.
All right, now back to the thing that you really came here for, the news. A new report from IDC says that server revenue declined 4.6% worldwide for the first quarter of 2017. IDC says the major cause for the decline is that hyperscale buyers are waiting for the deployment of Intel's new Skylake processors, which we talked about a little bit last show. There's a few interesting tidbits in the report. First, even as revenues were down for the quarter, shipments actually went up by just over 1%. I found that interesting. Second, IDC said that a single customer bought more than 10% of the total servers shipped in Q1. That's about 250,000 boxes.
Yeah, no surprises. We've talked about this a fair bit over the months, is that when Intel CPUs get to the end of the cycle, everybody knows what's coming. So why would you buy the obsolete stuff? You know, you would hold off. And a lot of the megascales are the LinkedIns and the Tencents and the Alibabas of this world are in a position to, I can delay my data center build for 2 or 3 months to get that more modern CPU. And when you're buying 100,000 of them, makes perfect sense, right?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. So this shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. It will also, if you're a publicly traded company, you won't be very happy, of course. So if you're Dell or HPE or Cisco, the fact that customers are delaying buying those servers, because this happens in the enterprise, although less so, but they are now very, very excited because they've got a new toy to go and flog off to all of you enterprise customers who listen to this podcast. You'll be, salespeople will be pounding your door down trying to convince you to buy the next generation of servers.
Yeah, revenue growth was lower for all the brand name server vendors compared to last year, except for Dell, whose year-on-year revenue actually grew 4.7%. And in terms of market share, HPE is still sitting at the top of the pile, and Dell and Cisco taking second and third place, respectively.
Mm-hmm. No surprises there. You know, you would think that Dell EMC might be picking up the business that's running out of IBM, I think. What used to be IBM Lenovo, there might be a certain group of customers who might think that Dell EMC might be better suited to their needs.
That's right. And HPE is also counting servers that they're selling through their partnership with HC3. So they're, I don't know if that's cooking the books or not, but that I think gives them a boost in terms of their overall position.
Well, it's definitely, HPE owns 49% of H3C.
Yeah.
You know, as a joint venture with Tsinghua. We talked about that in terms of the networking stuff. And so, yeah, sure, they are selling their servers over there. And Tsinghua, in that sense, is a reseller, if you like, or the H3C is a reseller of HP products. So that's perfectly fine. And the networking business unit went to H3C as well. So it's interesting to see how they're making that out in the modern era.
And just a couple observations for me. One, that I think the OEMs are looking for ways to differentiate and perhaps even justify some higher margins. Thinking about Cisco with their recent announcement of their latest UCS servers, they're positioning them as quote-unquote systems rather than just individual boxes, and they're adding new capabilities and software to make them more cloud-like in terms of management and resource allocation, maybe to add a little value. And I remember when I was at HPE Discover earlier this year, the company rolled out their new ProLiant servers and called them, quote, the world's most secure industry standard servers. So again, trying to justify reasons for why you should go to them as opposed to someone else.
Yeah, well, this is tapping into this secure supply chain concept, in that it would be possible for people to hijack your servers and to insert malware into them in the supply chain. And I would think that for vendors who have really high profit margins, spending a little bit of time and effort claiming to have secure supply chains is worth doing. I'm not 100% convinced that there's real value to this. Like, is it worth extra 5, 10% markup on the product or not? I don't know. Maybe to many customers it could be, but at the end of the day, there's only so much chrome you can slap on the car before it stops being a car and becomes an art project.
Well, that's the thing. And I think that's why they're trying to find ways to say, you know, our chrome is better than their chrome.
Yeah. And they do need to differentiate. Ultimately, everybody's just rebadging Intel's x86 silicon, and they need to do something to it. So, you know, the diversity of HPE's ILOs or Dell's Drax or Cisco's UCS management thing, that's not a lot of differentiation. You're talking really just 5% of the product is differentiated in those management platforms. And I was talking to some people who manage a lot of servers, and they said it's just not practical to even use those at scale because they're just too difficult to use and they're not actually that very not reliable. So different folks for different folks. If you've got plenty of time and, you know, ultimately you're managing a fleet of servers, but you're not actually doing much but upgrading that firmware, well, you might like them because they give you some access to some resources. But as I said, I still regard most of what you see in a Cisco or a HP or a Dell server as chrome, not necessarily adding real value at the core of the product. All of that comes from Intel.
All right, moving on. Ashley Madison, you may remember them. They're a website that connects people who want to have an affair. They settled a class action lawsuit for $11.2 million, and this suit stems from their 2015 data breach that exposed the supposedly private user details they were keeping.
Not to try and belittle this, of course, is that Ashley Madison was a huge furore back in 2015. And I've held it up as a sort of a, you know, how much money did they make in terms of marketing? But that there was a lot of people who were negatively impacted, of course. Their personal details leaked out and spouses found out that they'd been having affairs. And some people, I think, even went so far as to commit suicide or, you know, run away and disappear and stuff. So very sad outcomes to that. But if you look at this as a pure business play, do you think Ashley Madison's made $11.2 million in marketing value?
I mean, if we're saying that bad coverage is just as good as good coverage, then certainly in terms of free ad dollars, yeah, they got it.
Bad coverage is better than no coverage.
That's exactly right.
It's usually the story there. And I do feel that, you know, they've gotten off quite cheaply here. This was a company that nobody had heard of. And last time I checked on their financial results, we saw some articles a year or so ago, their business was booming for them, literally because of the exposure. So I don't think this highlights the fact that data breaches don't usually kill your business. They might cause you a setback at worst, but quite often they're actually beneficial. You know, most other companies pick up and keep moving. But I am changing my opinion in that your security probably shouldn't be oriented for a data breach and preventing exfiltration. What you need to be worried about is data destruction. And we saw Petya and NotPetya, that ransomware coming up over the last 3 to 6 months, we've seen some quite virulent, and they're not even attempting to get financial returns off that money. They're just destroying off your data. They're just destroying it outright. So the company Maersk, who actually runs container shipping at a lot of major, they're still not online. And there's some suggestions that Maersk may not be able to, they still haven't been able to find all of the containers that are stranded at ports, and may even affect things like Apple's products coming out in September because a lot of the raw materials have been stranded at various ports around the world. Destruction is a completely different security posture to exfiltration, you know, or data breach.
Right. Although I have to say, I generally agree with you that data destruction is now probably top of the list as a key concern, except in the case of a company like Ashley Madison, where the whole premise is this is secret. And so a data breach and exfiltration is actually the worst thing that could happen to them because their whole company is premised on keeping it hush-hush.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, it doesn't seem to have affected them at all.
The other thing that's interesting is I wonder, apparently this class action suit had potentially 37 million folks attached to it.
I'll bet you they don't all show up.
Well, that's right? The thing. I mean, it's you have to essentially try to document and prove that you were harmed by the exposure. And if you do so, you can claim up to $3,500. But have to wonder how many folks are actually going to try to pull a claim out of this, which means that money's just going to sit there.
Yeah. Well, you know.
Except for the lawyers, who will get a third of it.
That's right. Apparently the lawyers are going to get a third of that. It could be a nice payoff depending on how much effort they've put into it. I just think it comes down to this. You know, you need to adjust your security strategy. Don't focus on a data breach. Focus on data destruction, I think, is the weak part, or espionage, and adjust your security policy to that rather than – there was a big thing about data exfiltration a while back, detecting people who were stealing creds and stuff like that, and that doesn't seem to have been an issue.
Mm-hmm. No, I take your point. Data destruction is now the name of the game.
Yes. It's sort of coming to the opinion that it's kind of like all of the fingers sort of point back to the Russians on this Petya, not Petya, and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, it all started in the Ukraine. I just can't shake the sense that this is a bit like nuclear testing. This is the cyber equivalent of nuclear testing back in the 50s and 60s. It was, you know, saber rattling and saying, look, I've got a nuclear bomb too. And then you blow it up to prove that you've got one. And I can't help feeling that the Petya outbreak in Ukraine was partly to damage the Ukraine, but also partly to sort of say to the people who are watching, we've got the nuclear bomb as well. Be careful.
That's interesting and frightening because, as with setting off nuclear weapons, there's fallout that spreads everywhere. It's the same thing with these malware attacks. They tend to have unintended targets and consequences.
That's right. And, you know, obviously the Ukrainian stuff got out of control.
Right.
Went worldwide. More finesse needed.
Yeah, I believe some Russian banks actually were hit with some of this, I think. So,
yeah.
It's hard to prove provenance, but these weapons, they have no loyalty, let's say.
No. But once they're out, they're out. And also, once they're used, they're spent. They're not something, it's not like a normal thing where you can just make another one and then blow it up again. Once these cyber weapons are actually used, the vendors will cover the software gaps or the government will legislate to prevent them.
In theory.
Yeah. Well, usually true. Yes. Over time, over some temporal exigency.
Okay. Moving on, the tech news site The Information is citing unnamed sources saying that Amazon and VMware are in conversations about developing software to sell to enterprise data centers.
I would imagine that this is fairly easy to rumor because AWS and VMware have already teamed up in the data center.
They have, yes.
Yeah, been building clouds. So you could probably make up anything and it would sound plausible at this point.
Well, there's also, you know, you see some competitive alignment in terms of Microsoft. They are launching Azure Stack for private clouds, and they've even signed up Dell EMC as a partner already who's providing a hardware platform so you can run Azure Stack in your data center and then also nice and easily connected up to the Azure public cloud. So it seems plausible that Amazon might be interested in this, but it's a rumor.
As we've said before, Amazon needs a private cloud strategy. Azure's got one, and they've effectively released a private cloud, which is an on-ramp to Azure. That makes it very easy for customers to just casually move down a road and suddenly find themselves stuck on Azure and no way out of it. And Azure Private Cloud is absolutely that. You've got Windows servers, you're running your own Windows, you then run Azure Private Cloud, and then you start services. You can just do backup straight into Azure out of Private Cloud. You start to say, well, I'll do, you know, more and more of the services, and then over a 10 to 20 year time frame, suddenly you're on Azure Cloud. You didn't even know you did it. So I do feel that AWS and VMware are probably having a partnership. I'm sure VMware and Azure are having partnerships. I'm sure VMware and SoftLayer, IBM SoftLayer, VMware and Oracle. I think they're all looking for partnerships because I think they've all got customers who run their software and they want to make sure they're providing all the customers all the things so they capture all the money.
That's the goal.
That's the goal, right? And so in this particular point in time when we're going through the market transition, these sorts of rumors don't really have a lot of value. What it says is, yeah, they're probably all talking. let's not overdo them, though.
Quick break to tell you that this episode of Network Break is being brought to you by IT Pro TV. Did you know the U.S. alone has more than 500,000 open tech positions? Cybersecurity jobs are at the top of that list. IT Pro TV's online IT training can help you fill that skills gap so that you're prepared for what lies ahead. IT Pro does IT live every day, so you know you're getting the most current IT training. Here's some examples. They offer over 2,000 hours of on-demand training with more than 125 hours added weekly. And their team solution provides group pricing and access to the IT Pro TV Supervisor Portal. You can gain full control over your team's training schedule, create custom groups and training assignments, and see individual and group analytics. And you and your team can stream IT Pro TV's courses live and on demand worldwide via Chromecast, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV on a PC, or by using iOS or Android apps. There's no need to send staff off-site for training. Courses include Certified Ethical Hacker, Kali Linux, ISC2 Security Certs, and more. So you can go to itprotv.com/networkbreak and use the code NETWORKBREAK30 to try it free for 7 days and get 30% off your monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. To learn more about IT Pro TV's team solution, sign up for a free demo of their supervisor portal. That's itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code NETWORKBREAK30. All right, back to the news. The FDIO project, which is overseen by the Linux Foundation, has announced that it's doubled its packet throughput using the latest Intel Xeon Scalable architecture.
So one of these days when software matters and hardware matters too.
That's right. It's true. You know, it was like the perfect melding here.
Yeah, we seem to keep coming back to this theme, don't we? You know, it's like everybody's like, software, all the things. It's only software that matters. Oh, look, it gets twice as fast when you put a bigger engine in it. Oh, we love
Wait,
the
hardware matters. Hardware is what
yeah,
it is.
Yeah, that's right. So, of course, the FD.io is an open source project that is largely led by Cisco after they outsourced a bunch of code. And they're demonstrating not only that good software gets good performance, but you can also use silicon to accelerate it to quite astonishing levels. Like the actual numbers in the blog post are very, very astonishing. Go and check it out for yourself. There's no point in reciting the numbers here. But you're talking sort of like just a few years ago, you would have spent $250,000 for a custom silicon router to get this sort of performance. And now we're getting it out of Intel's x86 packet, silicon x86 architecture using the DPDK. That's the data plane data kit where there's actually silicon acceleration in the CPU itself. This isn't NIC specific. This is the thing. I just want to express a bit of a caveat here. This is not a criticism. This is somebody sort of highlighted to me recently that some people say that the DPDK is not open and should not be used. That is, it's not open source. It's very Intel specific. While the use of DPDK is open enough, nobody else can build a DPDK compliant piece of silicon. So when you get onto PPC or ARM processor architectures, you won't be able to get the sort of acceleration that people are getting using the DPDK toolkit, which is the point of FDDIO in part, is to be able to provide high performance networking, including very high levels of route lookup performance. So routing, fundamentally networking or network services functionality, not only on x86, but on whatever CPU architecture needs to be used. So I'm kind of a little baffled by, let's claim about, talk about great performance on DPDK on x86, but we also do ARM and PPC too. So just keep that in mind. But it does bode very well for Contiv. Cisco has leading another project called Contiv, which is about container networking, particularly in Kubernetes, using the VPP and the FDD.io virtual switching engine at this sort of performance actually bodes very positively that we might actually have a container networking virtual switch and a strategy that could dominate and we could see less of a fractured container networking market. Like right now, container networking is a dumpster fire. It's literally a dumpster fire, and right above it is a tanker of fuel, and the stopcock is wide open, and it's just lit, right? It's just
this is a Michael Bay movie, you're saying. Just explosions ready to happen everywhere.
Every time I go in and people are starting to do sidecars, like a proxy on every container so they can network the containers. I'm like, really? This doesn't feel like progress. Anyway, so at the end of the day, Intel's fancy new Skylake CPU, which is everybody's excited about, is twice as fast when you network it. Hoorah.
Hoorah. And I think if I read the press release right, FDIO was essentially saying they didn't even do anything to change their software for this new hardware. The new chip came out, and running the current version of their software, they essentially doubled their performance.
Yeah, silicon matters. The services and the features are all in the software, but the silicon still matters, same as it always ever was.
All right. Ericsson has reported a dismal second quarter with an operating loss of $145 million on sales that are just a hair over $6 billion. The company didn't meet analyst estimates on either sales or gross margins.
No, not too much of a surprise for those of you who are following along at home. Ericsson is in deep trouble, it would seem, at the moment. It's definitely not firing on all cylinders, and they've had the new CEO come in, and he's not been able to pump it up back to life, and you know, so on and so on. The reason that I'm picking it up, because Ericsson is a really big player, or was historically, you know, like the company who's provided the backbend, the 3G, 4G, 5G equipment, and they usually sell it as a portfolio. So that is, They'll go to a carrier, roll out the radio network, and then manage it and operate it for them as an outsourcing type of thing. And if that business is coming to an end, then potentially Ericsson's entire business model might be coming unstuck. The rise of open source would, I think, be something that could be a day of unhappiness for them. And it might be reflected in the fact that 5G is coming and customers are holding back on their 3G, 4G spending, and that's affecting them. They actually said they're going to have to go back to some customers and renegotiate their contracts.
Right, which they said is going to have an ongoing negative performance on their income.
I know. I mean, like, what? How do you go back to a customer? Like, I suspect they've negotiated contracts, which is they take a revenue split for running the network with the customer, and which probably seemed like a good idea a few years ago when the market was up and up, but maybe the downside is hitting them hard. So I think ultimately the winner here might be Cisco. We've seen consistent rumors that Cisco is going to buy Ericsson, and Chuck Robbins has consistently said, no, we're just partners. And so it could go two ways. As Ericsson continues to fall, Cisco sales reps might move in and start feeding off Ericsson's customers, and they get all of the Ericsson customers as through a partnership without actually having to put a ring on it, if you like. Or the other way is that Ericsson continues to fall. Like, it fell quite a bit, like 10% last week, from $7.40 to $6.20 now. If it continues to fall, it might actually be that Cisco can't afford not to buy it. So it's going to be interesting time to watch that one continue on.
Okay, well, here's another little puzzle piece for the machinations that you're playing out in your head. Light Reading's reporting that Cisco's going to close its small cell business unit by the end of this month. They're sourcing the story from a report by Current Analysis that's only available to subscribers, so we'll just have to take Light Reading's word for it. Cisco's phasing out its 3G and 4G small cell products. It's also altering the terms of a deal it had with a startup called Spider Cloud Wireless. Spider Cloud can sell its own small cell gear through Cisco channels, but Cisco isn't going to resell or rebrand that equipment. Greg, you'd mentioned Ericsson maybe being a Cisco target. This Light Reading story notes that this move could positively affect Cisco and Ericsson's relationship because Spider Cloud competes with Ericsson.
Yeah, I think it's possible. So maybe Cisco wants to resell the Ericsson small cell business unit, but I'm not sure that the small cell business unit products have actually sold all that well. In that 3G, 4G, that's not been so much of an issue in terms of getting small cells out. There hasn't been the massive boom market that I think they expected it to be. And while it's been useful to use small cells to get coverage, mainly at corporate customers, so corporate customers have been saying, I'm doing a deal with carrier X, and you go and buy 5,000 handsets to run in your building, and the network that you just bought from doesn't work so well because there's 5,000 handsets in a single building. So, you know, part of the deal when you buy that many handsets is that they come in and put small cells inside of the enterprise. That's quite common. But whether there's been like mass take up in the consumer market, and the consumer market is really where it is, I suspect that Cisco's just pivoting to focus on 5G here. And maybe it's looking at Ericsson as the 5G supplier of choice that it partners with, and then it would then just abandon its 4G, 3G portfolio as it migrates to 5G and stops trying to do the telecom, the RAN stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? Of course, I've got no information, and it's not a market I normally track at any level. But you could certainly see that Cisco's penetration into the RAN market has been relatively limited. You've still got Nokia, Huawei, ZTE, and all those companies very aggressively getting into that market. And maybe Cisco's repositioning itself away. And that's not a business it's ever been number one or number two in. So maybe it's time to say call time on that, focus on its IoT and its x86 business, which is where the growth is, and try and stop the bleeding in the enterprise and focus on those businesses.
Right. Could be.
Maybe, maybe not.
Maybe, maybe not, but something we'll keep an eye on. All right. Our last story for the day, Arista is down just over 4% as the ITC keeps Cisco-related import ban in place. This is a story that you just pulled off of Seeking Alpha, Greg.
Yeah, the usual bitch slapping between Cisco and Arista continues. This time, I believe there's some sort of import bans in place. We talked about it, I think, a couple of weeks ago, that Cisco got the customs to ban the products from being imported because the patents have been violated. Anyway, whatever it is, Arista lost this round. Who knows what it'll be next week?
Like hardware versus software, Cisco versus Arista is up and down.
It's always up and down. Although, to some extent, it's gone in Arista's favor lately. They've had a string of wins. And today they've had a string of losses, and so the share price is readjusting as people rebalance their risk and say, oh, maybe they're not going to win after all. So pretty normal stuff. Just wanted to flag it up. We've covered it so far. We feel like we should just continue to keep the messaging going. Link to the article in the notes.
All right. And that's it for this week's news. Please stay tuned to hear our sponsored Coffee Talk conversation with Thousand Eyes. It's going to be about monitoring network performance in AWS, and that's coming right up. Welcome to Coffee Talk. Today we're talking with Thousand Eyes, our sponsor for this segment, about monitoring performance and availability in Amazon Web Services. Our guests are Archana Kesavan and Nick Hephart from Thousand Eyes. Archana, I'm going to start the conversation with you by asking, why do AWS customers need to monitor their connectivity?
Yeah, so AWS has really been a popular choice for enterprises, right, when they're looking at moving to the cloud. And we see a lot of our customers either already on AWS or are looking to move to AWS. And very clearly, they own the cloud computing space. But as enterprises are thinking about moving to services, they need to think critically about monitoring and visibility from really two different perspectives. One is with respect to how are these services performing within their own VPC inside AWS. And, you know, CloudWatch, which is Amazon's monitoring service, does a good job there. They give you insight in terms of how the host or the infrastructure is performing, what is the amount of traffic coming into their VPC and egressing out. But it really lacks the perspective of end user experience. And that brings us to the second aspect of monitoring that enterprises need to be concerned about, because at the end of the day, businesses really care about the end user experience and the delivery of these services to the customers, which is why monitoring connectivity to AWS becomes critical. So once you think about end-to-end delivery, right, there are more factors that come into play than the actual environment in which they are being hosted. The users are accessing AWS services from really different parts of the world, and traffic goes through what we know as the internet. And the internet is really a coalition of different ISPs in there. So other than looking at just how is my application performing internally within the infrastructure as a service provider, AWS in this instance, it also becomes important to understand how are my users accessing these services. That's the first part of, you know, why is it essential to monitor connectivity to AWS?
So it's really about that visibility, isn't it? Even though AWS gives you a whole bunch of services and you think it's not a managed service. They're not actually there to provide you with the full thing. They just give you a bunch of hammers, but it's still not necessarily a solution. I don't think a lot of people understand that.
Yeah, exactly. It's the end-to-end solution that matters, and AWS really gives you information and data on a part of it. So having that end-to-end visibility and connectivity aspect of it starts getting important. We're also seeing a lot of our customers, you know, take a really hybrid approach to data center architectures. They're either phasing out their move towards AWS, or because of redundancy, they're distributing services either on their on-prem data centers and then a part of the microservices within AWS. And at that instance, the connectivity between the data center and AWS starts becoming important as well. So that's the other perspective, you know, in terms of monitoring and connectivity, what customers need to be aware of.
So networks are going to network. So just because you're in the cloud doesn't mean you don't have the problem of you can't count packets on the wire. That problem still exists in the cloud just the same as it does on the internet connection in your own data center.
Yeah, exactly.
And IT needs some kind of monitoring so that if a user is reporting a problem, obviously they can go into CloudWatch and see if it's there. But if it's not, they've got to have some other recourse to try to figure out what's going on.
Right. And that's really interesting, right? Because if you remember the recent AWS S3 outage that happened earlier in the year, customers were depending on CloudWatch to provide some level of insight into what's happening couldn't really get that insight because CloudWatch happened to be one of the services that was affected as well. So they were really stranded in terms of understanding what's going on. So having another set of eyes, no pun intended there, that's getting really critical.
Yeah, so actually that's an interesting point, because if your monitoring service in the cloud goes down, then you're totally invisible without some kind of third party outside.
Amazon exactly. Had that problem. Remember, their status page was hosted on the same site that was down.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, which was a bit embarrassing. So let's talk a little bit more about how Thousand Eyes can then get visibility back into AWS. How do users benefit from this visibility, Nick?
Sure. So Thousand Eyes provides this end user experience or visibility monitoring. And we do that by taking a look at a bunch of the different services that AWS is providing. So you can understand connectivity to an instance like an EC2. You can understand connectivity to an endpoint like a content endpoint, for instance, with CloudFront or web application firewall, a whole host of different things. Mm. And also understand the network connectivity between AWS and whatever point your users might be located in. So that could be from a specific laptop or desktop. That could be from a geographic region. And by providing this information in context of the actual web service you care about hosted by Amazon, you can understand whether, you know, a network connectivity issue that you might see is particularly interesting or not and warrants, you know, your further attention.
But one of the challenges with AWS is that they always want to use their tools to monitor their services. But the reality is that an awful lot of stuff is actually outside of AWS. So I think what you just said there was you're actually correlating data outside of AWS, your existing ThousandEyes portfolio, which we've talked about a few times, you know, this internet monitoring as well as the end user experience, this end user monitoring nodes that you have. You're going to bring all of those together to say this is where the problem is, and it may or may not be AWS.
Yeah, and I mean, you can definitely find issues where it might be in your own infrastructure, it might be in a third party in between. Many of these applications also have lots of other dependencies, both within AWS as well as external to that. And so trying to understand exactly what's the scope of a problem and who's responsible for different portions of it becomes really important. And so being able to rule in and rule out AWS as maybe an issue or not is important, particularly when you're constrained by whatever CloudWatch will tell you and not being able to have some of those typical network monitoring techniques you might expect in your own data center. And by doing that, you can actually do things like plan out what a deployment or traffic flows might look like ahead of time. You can baseline performance to understand where you might want to deploy certain resources within AWS or how you might want to connect them up to your own data centers. And then obviously you can do some very specific troubleshooting as well. So it's fairly flexible in terms of how you can use the various vantage points in these cases. They're actually software-based agents that you can run within AWS, outside AWS, lots of different perspectives you can provide.
Okay,
there.
So you're actually using those end user experience nodes and putting them inside AWS to monitor it, say, as if you were directly connected or inside your data center. And that way you can correlate the end user nodes that are outside the data center.
Yeah, so like an example would be we have some of our customers, particularly customers that use multiple AWS regions or also multiple AWS availability zones and want to understand what's the performance look like between those different parts of the infrastructure. They can actually set up these agents in each different region they care about. They may also want to have a perspective from outside of that, maybe in their own on-premises data center or maybe just some external vantage point on the internet. And so between these various points, you can, you know, set up specific data collection and monitor the performance between them.
So you're saying not only could I monitor like the connection I've got between, you know, my enterprise headquarters into AWS, the ISP that's connecting the two, but also how performance is happening between AWS regions.
Exactly. So one of the things that Archana definitely has some points here to talk about, she's been looking into actually what does performance look like between those regions. And so we've really tried to understand a bit more about what does the AWS network topology look like, because I think it's a bit different than what maybe many people expect.
Okay, this sounds fun. You've got some statistics for us.
Let me try and just make sure I sync this up in my head, because my head's always a bit strange. But in AWS, I've built an application and it's there, it's running. What I want to do is measure how that application is performing. Now, a lot of people will put stuff inside the code, but I think the way ThousandEyes is doing it is you've got this distribution of cloud agents all over the internet, and they're the ones that you have, or there's ones that I could build. I could go and put cloud agents in my own branch offices or at people's homes if I wanted to monitor them, for example, and actually pull stuff in the app that I have got running in AWS. Is that conceptually how it works as a big picture?
Yeah, I mean, conceptually, there's really two options. One, you can monitor from one of those vantage points an agent to a service. So you could monitor a web service, you could monitor a file transfer, a voice service, lots of different services within AWS. Almost everything in AWS will respond with some HTTP response. So we can monitor that and without any sort of code level instrumentation. You can also monitor between two agents. So if you want to just get a pure network perspective of the world, so understand from AWS, US East 1 to US West 1, you'd be able to understand what does latency look like, what kind of loss, what paths do I take. So you have a few different options, whether you want to monitor a service or maybe monitor to another agent.
So Archana, then you had some details, you've actually got some information on what general performance looks like between these AWS regions.
Yeah, so when we talk about AWS, it's obviously not a single entity. AWS has, they've really broken down their network into what they call regions. And there are 14 different regions that are spread across the world. So if you look at it, a region is really an independent, geographically independent part of the network. And it's made of up of these smaller entities called availability zones that Nick was referring to earlier, or, you know, people call it AZs as well. So what we did is these two options that Nick just spoke about, understanding either through performance through these global vantage points, or understanding performance purely from a network level across regions, across availability zones by deploying our agents within AWS itself. We've gathered some really interesting data here. So if you look at AWS inter-AZ, inter-availability zone performance, we notice that it really depends on the region that we're talking about. What that means is that the US East Virginia region, the inter-AZ latency is around 2 milliseconds. But when we look at it in Europe, London specifically, it was 5 times more than the US East. So that was kind of really interesting. And also that the latencies in Europe fluctuate a bit more compared to US East, for example.
Yeah, well, that's true. And a lot of that's to do with the way that the internet works, but also to do with AWS's internal networks also sometimes trunks the data. So there's no predictability in the cloud, is one of the things I've often said to people. I mean, you can't rely on it to be one thing or another.
Yeah. Right. The interesting thing is any traffic that once enters AWS, they really make sure it stays within AWS till it has to actually egress out. So if customers or enterprises are deploying services across multiple regions, which they can do for, you know, performance or event redundancy perspective, once traffic is entered, say, AWS East, but has to access a service in AWS West, the path is really purely within the AWS network. So inter-region transit is entirely within the AWS network there. The other interesting aspect while we were doing a bunch of these, you know, analysis is that we noticed that the connectivity and the visibility drastically varies according to the region. And this could be because of, you know, different configuration within AWS that are really region specific. They could have different configuration and policies within different regions itself. So that was something that was interesting that we found out.
And you've also got some data on how AWS peers with ISPs.
Yeah, that was really interesting data that we collected. We were monitoring multiple AWS regions from, you know, global vantage points, just seeing not just latency and performance measurements, but also trying to understand how routing works, right? And what we noticed is that by default, traffic enters the AWS network closest to the region the traffic is destined to. So what this means is that if you have services that are hosted in AWS West in Northern California, for example, and users in Europe were accessing that service, they do not enter the AWS European data center. The traffic's really passed through other ISPs, and the peering is in San Jose, where they enter the AWS network. So Amazon really chooses to send traffic across continents through other providers instead of absorbing the traffic into the AWS network, which is really closest to where traffic originates. So that was another interesting data point there.
That's fascinating, because Google makes a big thing about the fact that it'll trunk it across its own backbone when it can, I think. And that's why Google computes better than AWS. So having that data at hand to prove why is very interesting to me. And I think to users, knowing that that is actually happening, because this is not talked about. AWS doesn't talk about how that sort of stuff is done. It's very opaque. AWS doesn't tell you how the cake's made. They just say, here, you can have the cake. You better like it.
No, yeah, exactly. And, you know, this is what we recognized with the network assets today. I know Amazon's making these investments in the undersea cables, so that's expected to go live in 2018. So we could, you know, see some changes in the architecture over time.
I hope so. So if I'm a customer and I've got AWS and they're coming at it from a Thousand Eyes perspective, and they're thinking, Thousand Eyes, they've just heard what we've talked about here about using Thousand Eyes to monitor some AWS stuff. So Nick, tell me, what is it they're going to do? How are they going to go about starting this path down there to get some visibility?
Right. So if you want to understand maybe a service that you host in AWS, you'd be able to use some of the vantage points we have around the world. So we have more than 100 different locations around the world that you can just with the click of a button be able to start monitoring that service from. And it's all sorts of things. You could do a Route 53 DNS record. It, again, could be a distribution on CloudFront. A lot of different stuff will work there. And you can start monitoring it right away. We also provide, by default, for free, a perspective of each of the different AWS regions. So if you just want to get a sense for a generic endpoint within an AWS region, you can just sign up for an account and be able to enable that data stream and see what it looks like. I mean, you can even see whether availability and latency and performance matches your expectations. Probably to do some more significant testing of your own services or from locations that you might care more about yourself, you can obviously set up agents in specific locations you care about. So that could be from your data center or branch office or some other point that matters to you. And those agents can run a variety of different ways. You can run them on Linux. You can run them as a virtual appliance. They'll also run as AWS instances. So you can use Ubuntu and other different Linux distributions as well as maybe a virtual box or Hyper-V or other environment in a variety of different locations. So
I think that's really cool because if you've got branch offices all over the world or all over a geography of some sort, and then you put an app into AWS and you've got no WAN, you can't monitor it anymore. This is a way of putting these ThousandEyes remote probes in each of your branch offices where your users are located and then testing the connectivity from those to the AWS region that you're using. So, for example, in Europe, your application might be hosted in Ireland and you might have offices all around Europe. So you put the probes all around Germany and the Netherlands and Norway and Switzerland and Spain and Greece, and then you start to monitor the relative performance of what the users in your organization are getting. And that's the first time you're going to get that visibility because there's no WAN monitoring of the internet, right?
Exactly. And so you'll be able to get that perspective from what you care about. So if you're hosting an internal service, you can place agents in your branches. If you're hosting maybe a service that's more public, you can use some of our hosted locations from a variety of locations. And you'll be able to see some of that stuff Arjun was talking about in terms of performance, peering. You know, AWS has all sorts of trickery with their prefixes and ASNs that you'll want to be aware of because it'll really influence what your performance looks like from different places.
So Nick, how do people get started with this? What's the process for doing, say, a test or an eval?
Absolutely. So you can sign up for free and use a set of locations to monitor from to AWS. You can do that on the ThousandEyes website, so www.thousandeyes.com. You can also check out Archana's latest webinar where she goes into more depth on AWS topics and get some more information on some specific tips in terms of monitoring AWS performance. And if you need some additional tips once you're in the product, we have a bunch of those existing tests already set up, so you can use them as templates of how you might want to set up a perspective from your own locations.
So that means I can go and sign up for free and start playing with it. I don't actually have to go and plonk down $1 million just to get the first one running.
You don't have to plonk down $1 million. You don't have to deploy anything to have it get some data running.
The cloud, Drew. It's not always about
It's not always about surveillance and all that stuff.
No, that's right. There you go.
All right. Well, that wraps up our conversation. Thank you, Archana and Nick, for joining us. And thanks to listeners for being here. You can find more fine, free technical podcasts at packetpushers.net. And while you're there, you can sign up for our free membership program, which will get you the weekly link propagation newsletter and biweekly Human Infrastructure magazine. For more details, head on over to packetpushers.net/members. Thanks for listening.